Kahal Nechbad. My mother-in-law, Aleha Shalom, was fond of quoting the itinerant preacher, the Darshan, who came to town and said in Yiddish, Eid ich will reden, will ich sagen etliche Werte. Before I speak, I would like to say some words. And so I, too, would like to say two words. The first word is to join Rabbi Adler in thanking the organizations that have sponsored this evening, but to give a special thanks to a very modest, retiring, and loyal Talmud of my father's, Harav David Shapiro, who was the moving force behind this evening. Thank you very much. The second thing I would like to do is share with you my personal feeling and my husband's feeling of satisfaction that it is my son, Harav Meir, that is speaking tonight in honor of my father. 20 years ago, it was our generation that spoke, and we are proud that the next generation is continuing this tradition and understands and can truly evaluate and share with you an assessment of my father. Thank you, Harav Meir. The 20th yard sight of my father, the Rav, it's very hard with this and this to read. Can you arrange it differently for me? This is in my way. If you could change it a bit, I would appreciate it. Thank you. Good. Okay. And if they don't hear you, let me know. The 20th yard site of my father, the Rav, is being marked in Israel, both by communities and in the press. Lectures, reminiscences, and articles have marked the day. And yet, it is this gathering here tonight that is different, and for me, very special. This evening, we are paying tribute not to Harav Soloveitchik, whose books on Machshava we have studied, or whose shiurim we have read, but to a person we knew who was respectfully called by the Orthodox non-Haredi community in the States, the Rav. This term is used in the States in the same manner that Harav Cook is called Harav in this country. It recognizes and acknowledges the Rav, the Talmid-Rav relationship, and assumes that one need not specify the name of the Rav, as it is clear to all who this Rav is. And so it was. My father, Harav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, was the Rav. Many of us tonight who are here tonight were his Talmidim. Many are children of his Talmidim, and many are Talmidim or Talmidot of his Talmidim. And it is to this relationship that I want to address myself this evening, reflecting with you on the Rav and the mutual relationship between him and the Torah community in the United States. My father, the Rav, arrived in the United States in August 1932. He was very young, only 29 years old. The scion of probably the most prestigious rabbinic family in Lithuania. His lineage included, as you know, Reb Chaim Mivolozhin, the Netziv, the Beit HaLevi, who he was named after, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, a lineage that the Rav once described in a different context as Shena Eden, as fine Jews, as indeed they were. And the Boston to which he came in December of that year was indeed no Makom Torah. Far from it. Close to 100,000 Jews lived in Boston. Yet the young people who were Shomrei Shabbat were few and far between. And those who could learn a Blat Gemara were able to fit around our dining room table, which was not very large. The kashrut situation in Boston needed major renovations, both technically and morally. Jewish education was, for all intents and purposes, non-existent. I often wonder, and very often do I wonder, about the cultural shock and the deep alienation that I assume my father felt, and the challenges he faced, learning a new culture, learning a new language, being in exile from a vibrant Torah committee and a community, excuse me, being in exile from a vibrant Torah community and having to forge one's way as a community rabbi. None of the models he knew from Europe seemed to fit Boston. He would have to learn to form something ex nihilo, yesh mi'ayin. And not quite 3 years later, Lag BaOmer, just this time of year, of 1935, finds the Rav in Tel Aviv, a candidate for the position of Chief Rabbi of Tel Aviv. I would assume that this reflected not only a desire to be in Tel Aviv, but also a desire to leave Boston. But that move was not to be. Tel Aviv was not interested. And the Rav returned to Boston after Shavuot to continue to forge his way in the strange environment. And yet, less than 20 years later, in the early 50s of the 20th century, the Rav had assumed a leadership role, and individuals and organizations turned to him for guidance and direction. The series of letters in the book, Community, Covenant, and Commitment, are witness to this phenomenon. The Rav was very... This is my dear sister-in-law who takes care of me all the time. The Rav was very un-American. And those of us who are old enough to admit to remembering the McCarthy period know that being un-American borders on treason. He spoke English with an accent. And what is more un-American than speaking with an accent? He rejected the American pragmatic ethos that was and still is a central theme in American life. Moreover, the American dream, the belief that the individual can achieve success in spite of obstacles and difficulties, an integral part of the woof and warp of American life, was not his dream in any manner or form. The American immigrants had come to the Golden Medina in search not only of bread, but also in order to allow their children to be part of the American dream. And they had indeed succeeded. The children of the poor immigrants were the professionals, the doctors, the lawyers, the dentists, and the accountants, of whom their parents were so proud. How then did the Rav become the Rav of this community? I would like to suggest that there were two major components: the development of the relationship between the Rav and the community. The first was his weekly shiur at Reitz, Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, known as Reitz of Yeshiva University. And the second, which is integrally intertwined and interwoven with the first, was his unlimited faith and pride in the relevance of Torah to modern life. The Rav began to say a shiur at Reitz in 1941, after the death of his father, Rav Moshe Halevi Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. He commuted weekly to New York. His shiur at Reitz, the effort he poured into it and the care he poured into it, the hours of preparation, the seriousness with which he related to the ideas and sugyot he learned and taught were the bedrock of the developing relationship with the young men, first and second generation Americans who studied at Reitz. In the Rav's own words, and I quote, "I feel most comfortable surrounded by young students delving into a difficult Rambam or Rashba, as opposed to when I am fulfilling the formal role of a rabbi, and my congregants honor me by waiting until I finish Shmona Esrei." However, these shiurim were not idyllic or comfortable, but were demanding both intellectually and emotionally. The emotional atmosphere was charged. This was not a lecture where the teacher drones on, the students passively listen or don't, take notes or don't, fall asleep, or play battleships. In those days, there were no computers to play solitude, so we all played battleships on pieces of paper. but a demanding interchange between student and teacher, where one needed to be on one's intellectual toes all the time, even if one had prepared the material and thought he had mastered it. No daydreaming, wandering attention, or passivity. The passion with which the Rev approached the material and his spontaneous outbursts when the students were lax with the order of the day. Students cringed at being found wanting and reveled in his praise. One would have expected then that the young men would stop coming to the Shayur, but they did not. They persevered and progressed year after year. Why? Why is the question that I want to address myself to today. Perhaps they realized they were in the presence of greatness. The Rav's intellectual stature and creativity were beyond question and recognizable even by rookies. One did not have to be a connoisseur of Torah to marvel at his Kiddushei Torah. He himself described this phenomenon, and I quote, Ha'adam b'shkedoto al daltot ha-Torah motzei et atzmuto, himself, his selfhood, v'atzma'uto, in his independence, u'boneh et olamo kulo mishalo, b'li siyua chitzoni, hu ha'adrichal ha'koveya et midat ha'binyan, tavnito u'mar'ehu, ha'seichel ha'objektivi, ba'al ha'bikoret ha'ma'of v'ha'hekef, who yisod ha-yisodot shel ha-isuk b'divrei Torah. Being part of the process through which the super-architect of Torah built his Torah edifice was both an intellectual and emotional experience and was appreciated by the young students. Or, perhaps, or additionally, the young men also recognized that the Rav's intellectual honesty was impeccable, and that he would as readily admit his fault as pointed out in the students. He was not demanding more of them than he demanded of himself. And primarily, I would like to suggest the young men recognized that this passion was an expression of deep commitment to Torah, a burning desire that it be understood and transmitted properly to the next generation, rather than a lack of respect for them. Had Torah ever been presented to them with such care, precision, or passion? Passion for the Torah? Passion for the Torah in the home of the free and the brave? On Amsterdam Avenue, of all places, this was almost unheard of. The Talmidim began the arduous process of reconnecting to a long tradition that had almost been forgotten in the new land. The main efforts of the community had been focused on being American rather than on connecting to the past and its tradition. The lack of rootedness that the young men felt, the disconnection from life in Europe and the world of Torah that was at the very period that the Rav started to say his Shayor and Reitz, being decimated cruelly and systematically, was being addressed not by sermons, or as Harav Beis Din Alav HaShalom was fond of saying, by talking about it, but by studying it. The young men at Reitz were not only reconnecting to Torah, but resurrecting it day by day, slowly and carefully, with care and devotion. This resurrection was a joint effort that was fueled and motivated by the Rav's unshaken belief in the truth of Torah and its eternal relevance. Many before me and many after me will have noted the steadfast belief that the Rav had in Torah and its relevance to life, be it in the 20th or in the 12th century. The quotation on the invitation to this evening's gathering is a summary of the Rav's position in his own words, and I quote, I have unlimited faith in the viability and vitality of Judaism and in the determination of the Jew to survive as a distinct spiritual entity within the general society. The rub was not bothered by what Professor David Schatz terms the great cognitive conflicts of our day. And in the opening pages of The Lonely Man of Faith, he declares that he has never been seriously troubled by evolution, the mechanistic interpretation of the human mind, fitting the mystery of revelation into historical empiricism, or by biblical criticism. Certainty in Torah was his lodestar. This belief in Torah, its viability and vitality, drove him to guide and goad his students to be proudly Jewish, proudly halachic in the public sphere, not only in the private one. He chided them that a proposed liturgical service seemed to him religiously infantile and similar to, quote, Christian Methodist sentimentalism, which exhausts itself in hymn singing and responsive reading, unquote. Or in a letter to the Rabbinical Council of America, he writes, I am shocked at the nonsensical attitude of our representatives in tolerating such a pitiful state of affairs and surrendering the most sacred prerogative of the traditional rabbinate, Hora'ah, to an apostle of a non-halachic brand of Judaism. The Rav said it as he saw it, and despite his being a truly polite and dignified person, he was not afraid of ruffling feelings in defense of the integrity of Torah. He resurrected the Torah with his Talmidim, and when they went on to positions of leadership, he kept reminding them, in his words, we should act independently, after our own fashion and manner, and in full accord with the halacha. And the community, both as individuals and communally, turned to him, knowing full well that he would not give them any discounts, that he would demand adherence to the halacha. The community responded to his challenge, accepted his authority, and tried its best. I have tried in these past few minutes to portray the process by which the Rav became the Rav of the American religious community. I have highlighted several facets of that relationship, but the heart of that relationship, I would like to contend, was Talmud Torah, sugya by sugya, masechet by masechet, week by week for four decades. Over time, and as a result of learning together, my father became the Rav and assumed the role of the father in the covenantal community. The Rav considered the relationship between Rebbe and Talmud a family one. This was the role he took, the father who instructs, teaches, at times reprimands and rebukes, and above all, who was deeply attached to his children and worried about their well-being. Just 20 years ago, when we returned from sitting Shiva for my father, Rav Ezra Bick, a Talmud, my father said, and I quote, if you had asked me before what my relationship was to the Rav, I would have said I was afraid of him. But if you would ask me that today, I realize I loved him. The Rav was not only father of his biological children, but of his Talmidim. I shared my father with all his Talmidim children, and even today, I feel a spiritual kinship with each and every one of them. The father in the covenantal community, wrote the Rav, is dedicated, quote, to the great educational commitment to the Masorah, the tradition, the freely assumed obligation to hand down, to pass on to the child the covenant, a message, a code, a unique way of life, a tradition of mishpat utzdaka, of justice and charity. And we have gathered here today all of the Talmidim and children, the children Talmidim, to pay tribute to the Rav and thank him for all he has given us.